The Buddha said, who knows dependent arising knows the Dhamma. Who knows the Dhamma knows dependent arising. Which means that the teaching of the depend origination is the centerpiece of his Dhamma and shows us the cause and effect that exists within us and outside of us. There are two teachings of dependent origination. The one that is more widely known is called the Lokya Paticca Samuppada. Lokya means the worldly. It is the worldly dependent origination. And we can make it even longer, the name. We can call it the worldly 12-point dependent origination, because it has 12 points. And you have probably seen and have already discussed at other times the drawing that goes with it. The circle of samsara, which starts out with ignorance and goes through the cycle of three, the past life, this life, and the future life, from ignorance to renewed birth and death. And within that cycle, there is one doorway where we can step out of that cycle. And that doorway is between feeling and craving. All the other steps, all the other dependent arisings are automatic causes and effects, unless we step out there. Now that point between feeling and craving is exactly the point that I've mentioned earlier today when I said, don't move impulsively, instinctively, when you have an unpleasant feeling. That's it. Right there. Unless we learn to live with unpleasant feelings and with pleasant ones without wanting to get rid of one and without wanting to keep and renew the other, we don't have access to that doorway. Then we keep on circling around in samsara over and over again. Now, obviously, it is impossible for anyone without practice and training not to react to unpleasant or pleasant feelings. But at least we can make a start somewhere. Unless we make a start at some time, we haven't got any handle on the path. So this is where we can make a start, right here now, when the feeling in the body is unpleasant because of posture or because of sickness or because of anything at all. When that feeling is unpleasant, to try and react to it with equanimity. Equanimity is that fourth one of the four Brahma Viharas, which is also one of the seven factors of enlightenment. Equanimity is the pinnacle of all emotions. It is not indifference. I will talk about equanimity at another time. But it is the one emotion that we need to cultivate and foster within us so that our feelings no longer get the better of us. As long as they get the better of us, we are a victim. We are victims of our feelings, we are victims of our emotions, and being a victim means we are not really free. The Buddha's teaching teaches us freedom. Freedom means being independent. This one step in that whole chain of dependent arising is the one we need to pay attention to. Everything else are automatic results of the primary fact of ignorance. Now, ignorance in the Buddhist terminology, in Pali, avijja, does not mean that we have no education. On the contrary, it is often said about the Westerner, they have far too much education. It means that we are ignoring the basic facts of existence. And that ignoring, which results then in ignorance, is the underlying cause for the then following chain of causation. From ignorance come the karma formations, which are the mental formations, which are thoughts. It's sankhara, which is the second step, are our thoughts. They are forming, and with that forming, we are also forming karma. Within our thought processes lies our karma. We've got to watch our thoughts. That's what meditation is all about. To eventually become master of one's mind, so that the mind does exactly what we want it to do. And is no longer playing games with us. As long as it plays games, we have no control over its formations, and therefore our karma is a mixture of wholesome and unwholesome. And then it goes down the chain. From the karma formation comes the rebirth consciousness, and from the rebirth consciousness we get mind and body. That too is an important point to look at, because the picture that is usually shown is of a boat with a passenger lying prone in the boat and another one paddling the boat. The one who's paddling the boat is the mind. The one who's lying prone there and being carted around is the body. So this is another very significant aspect that we need to watch: mind, thought, because body just follows along with what mind gives out as orders. From that we get our sense doors, which are five plus thinking, so there are six shown. And from the sense doors, we get sense contact. All this is automatic. There's nowhere we can put a stop to any of that. We wouldn't want to. We wouldn't want to put a stop to having the sense doors, nor can we put a stop to having sense contact. At this point in time, the contact that we're making is one of touch. one of sound and one of sight, and hopefully also one of thought. So all these contacts are being made at this time, and we are constantly making contact. We're constantly having something that we either see, hear, taste, touch, smell, or think. With these sense contacts, there is an automatic result of feeling. The Arahant, the fully enlightened, also makes sense contacts and has feeling. There's nothing wrong with feeling. The feelings that come from the sense contacts are three kinds: pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And our reaction to it then gives them the kind of names and kind of importance, whatever our mind wants to do with them. When it's unpleasant, we can say pain. When it's unpleasant, we can say anger. When it's pleasant, we can say lovely, whatever it is that our mind says. And here is the door from the feeling which has arisen from our sense contacts to the next step, which is craving. Now, craving is both. Craving is wanting to have and wanting to get rid of. It's the cause of all dukkha. It's the second noble truth. There is no other cause for dukkha except craving. And this is what makes our lives unfulfilled, unsatisfactory, which causes us to search for something else. Which is a good thing, because if we didn't search, we'd stay within that cycle of birth and death and wouldn't ever find the door out. Once we have missed our chance, however, when from feeling to craving we've missed the point and have already reacted with either like or dislike, then the causation chain takes its usual course and can't be stopped any longer. Because from the craving comes the clinging, and from the clinging, comes the becoming, and the becoming makes birth and death arise. And usually what we find on the explanations, we find that it says, and so arises all the dukkha. And it is always shown in a circular picture, which has usually three circles. The outer circle containing the 12 cause and effects, the middle circle containing the 6 realms of existence, and the inner circle containing the 3 unwholesome roots, greed, hate, and delusion, which are usually depicted by a snake, a cock, and a pig, who are holding each other's tail and are therefore making a circle of their own. The snake is the hate because of the poison she carries. The cock is the greed because he has a barnyard full of hens. And the pig is delusion because it covers its eyes up with dirt. Delusion means always, in Buddhist terminology, the illusion of a personal self. That is the root delusion. And this root delusion of having a personal self then brings with it all the other problems. We do have three wholesome roots also, which I may mention at another time. But at this time, the emphasis I would like to place is on the fact that there is a second dependent origination. And that one is called Lokuttara Paticca Samuppada, and Lokuttara means transcendental, otherworldly. And that one is not shown in a circle. That one is a straight line. And it goes from here to there. The circular one shows us the way it is drawn quite clearly, that we're caught in a net. And it was the Buddha himself who made that very first drawing of the circular one. He drew it in the sand, and the monks were so delighted with it, because it is an excellent teaching aid, that they asked permission to draw it themselves on the walls of the monastery. And the Buddha gave permission, and those were the monasteries in India in those days of the Buddha. And at that time, the Buddha also requested that in each monastery, one monk would be instructed in the exact meaning of this drawing, so that when visitors came, he could explain it to them. And this was done. But all the monasteries were destroyed in India when the Muslims came, and the drawings were then perpetuated in Tibet. And the drawings which we can find today are beautiful and elaborate, and are, of course, the artist's own imagination in it, but they go right back to the original instruction of the Buddha. Although the transmission says that they were much simpler in those days, because they didn't have the elaborate ornamentation, their substance is exactly what the Buddha taught. Now the second one does not have a drawing to it. The Buddha never made a drawing for it. He just taught it. And it shows us in very quick succession, in 12 steps again, how to get from this worldly existence to Nibbana. And I'm sure it's nothing new to you when I say that the whole of the teaching and the purpose of meditation in the Buddha's dispensation is nothing but getting from here to Nibbana. Now that may sound as if Nibbana is a place. Some people think like that. It's not. Nibbana is a state of mind. And we have that state of mind. Otherwise, we could never get there. But it's covered over. We haven't quite got to it yet. It's a state of mind. It's enlightened mind. In our tradition, the candles on the shrine are the symbol for enlightened mind, the light that the mind that's enlightened has. If we didn't have that within us, 45 years of teaching by the Buddha would have been in vain. After his enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, he first enjoyed, as it says, the bliss of Nibbana. And after having been there for a month, he considered spreading this news to others. And as he considered it, he thought that people would not be able to grasp the profundity of his teaching, and that would be a vexation to him. So he didn't want to teach. And the story says that the highest of the Brahmas, the highest of the god realms, Samapati, came to visit the Buddha and begged him to teach for the benefit of gods and men. And the Buddha reconsidered and with his divine vision looked to see that there were some people who had little dust in their eyes, which means little dust in their inner eye. And so he decided to teach. There are always those, and always have been those, that can use the teaching to go all the way to Nibbana. Then and now, nothing has changed. We have exactly the same problems that the people then had, and we have exactly the same potential and facility within us. And anything that we do in the Buddha's dispensation has that as its goal, as its purpose. It has as its goal and purpose the constant letting go of that which is covering over our nibbanic condition within our own mind. The transcendental dependent origination starts out with what the other one ends. The other one ends with dukkha. So arises all dukkha. This one starts out with dukkha. Dukkha does not mean tragedies. Dukkha does not mean necessarily pain. It does not mean being unhappy. It means all that, but it means far more than that. And that's why it is the one Pali word, which I never try to translate, because there are too many possibilities for it. It means that we cannot find total satisfaction anywhere within existence. Now, only when we have understood that will we no longer suffer from that. Until we are still looking for satisfaction. While we're still looking for satisfaction within the worldly existence, and we're looking for satisfaction from other people, from their appreciation, from their kindness, when we're looking for satisfaction in situations, because they are a good situation, because everything is there that we need, we're looking for satisfaction in our knowledge, in our own goodness, all this will disappoint us. That satisfaction cannot be there for one very simple reason, which we all know and constantly disregard, for the simple reason of impermanence. Anicca, dukkha, anatta are the three characteristics of the whole of existence. Anicca is impermanence, dukkha we know, anatta is directly translated non-self, means no core substance. As long as we are having an idea that there is something in the world that will make it possible for us to be totally happy permanently, so so long will be unhappy. It cannot be found. And this is our reason for not being happy. We look here, we look there. We go from one place to another. We move our residence. We change our partners. We change our diet. We change our religion. We change our meditation. We change our exercises. We go from one thing to the next. And what happens? We'll have to find another thing. It's called papancha. The word papancha in Pali really tells already the whole story, doesn't it? It has the sound of its meaning. Papancha means proliferation. Nature proliferates. If you look at the number of species of trees, birds, flowers, insects, the different colors everywhere to be found, the proliferation even in human beings. There are very few sitting here and none of them look alike, and yet they're all human beings. Nature proliferates, and as long as we go along with that, we are looking for something other than what we have. This looking for something other than what we have is dukkha. It means there's an emptiness within which wants to be filled. There's this little empty spot which wants filling up. And unless we see it quite clearly, we always try to fill it up from outside. Somebody is gonna do it for us. Realize that can we start a spiritual path. As long as dukkha, which arises within us, causes us to react in the many popular ways that are usually there, namely, first one is blame someone else. Very, very popular. And seems an easy way out. Doesn't work at all. Because not having dealt with that particular dukkha, it arises again and again. Our whole sojourn in this life is like an adult education class. And if we don't manage to pass the exams, we always have to go through the same class again. Just like in school. So one dukkha we can't deal with is bound to come up again. All it is another exam. So the first thing that we do with dukkha is blame someone else. Other times we may have the idea the best thing to do is to run away from it. And we have so many possibilities. Distraction. We don't even have to physically run away from it, although we do that too, of course. But we can run away through our distractions. Books, radio, discussion, all sorts of distractions are possible. If we don't do that, we can also try to become, have self-pity. Now that too is popular, of course quite useless and making us unhappy. And once that has set in, the next step is also very near at hand, namely depression. From self-pity it's not far to depression. Some people actually hang on to their dukkha. They want advice how to get rid of it. It's not well taken. And why is that? Because they feel alive with it. It's their own. They own it. So it gives them a sense of at least being there, even though it's dukkha. Dukkha is our best teacher. It is the one teacher that will not be persuaded by any kind of misery that we put out to let go of us. If we say to a human teacher, I don't feel well, my back aches, I can't get up in the morning, I'd rather go home. Well, the teacher will say, well, I'm very sorry, but if you want to go home, well, you must go home. If you say to Dukkha, look, I don't feel well, my back aches, I want to go home, Dukkha says, that's fine, I'm coming along. There's no way to say goodbye unless and until we have transcended it. Now, the transcending of Dukkha means that we have looked it squarely in the eye and seen it for what it is, a universal characteristic of existence and nothing else. It cannot be anything else. The reason we are fooled is because we have so many pleasant occasions also in this life. We have many pleasant sense contacts. There's a lot of pleasantness arising in our lives. So we are fooled by this and think, oh yes, if we could just keep this going, this pleasantness, then dukkha would never come again. And we have to try over and over again. Until in the end we finally see that the pleasantness will not keep going. It is impermanent. And yet, the whole of society, not only in the West, everywhere on this whole globe, is built up on just that concept. That pleasantness must be possible to perpetuate. This is how our economy works. You can't sell anything that doesn't provide pleasant feelings. Nobody's going to buy unpleasant feelings. So we keep on getting something else, getting something new, because everybody else is doing it too. The whole world lives like that. And it was so pleasant 5 minutes ago. So why can't we keep it that way? Why can't we continue? So we must get something else, or get the same thing back, and keep forgetting that that isn't possible to keep it going. And we also keep forgetting that that pleasantness is due to sense contact, and therefore has to be impermanent. No sense contact can remain permanent. It would become most unpleasant. Just imagine for a moment that you had a very nice meal and you say to your host, that was a nice meal, and the host says, oh, I'm so glad you liked it. We have so much food here. Please, keep on eating another 2 or 3 hours. Well, that's misery, isn't it? Physical and mental misery. A meal can last 20 minutes, 30 minutes at the very most, and then it's over. And then it has to be and then we have to get it again. Or for instance, we're very, very, very cold, and we want to take a hot shower. So we take a hot shower and we say to our friend, oh, this is lovely, wonderful, this hot water. And the friend says, oh, we've got plenty of hot water here. Be my guest, another 5 or 6 hours, wouldn't matter at all. Dreadful. Absolute misery. 10 minutes, 15 minutes. How long can one stay there? That we have to be finished before they become utter misery. And this is what we rely on. These contacts is what we rely on to make our life pleasant and happy. Whether these are actual physical contacts, like what I mentioned, or whether it's just another person or talking or anything like that. We rely on those things to make our lives happy. And yet, after having tried it many times, it must come to our notice that not only is it impermanent, but even when it is most pleasant, it leaves something to be desired. There is no total satisfaction, and that's dukkha. There is no total satisfaction. That's the only real translation of the word. And that, in our lives, brings us to the point where we think, well, if we can't find it in those sense contacts, and if we haven't found it with people, then we may be able to find it on the spiritual path. But even that may go astray if we don't realize that there too is lots of dukkha until the time we have transcended it all. The Buddha said there were four kinds of people that go on a spiritual path. One kind has a lot of dukkha and takes them a long time to get any results. Another kind has a lot of dukkha and they can do it very quickly, get results very quickly. Another kind has a lot of sukha, a lot of pleasant feelings, and it takes them a long time to get results. And another kind has a lot of sukha, and they can have quick results. There is that one kind with a lot of sukha and quick results. But if we don't belong to them karmically, we also have to accept the fact that as long as we are within existence, there will be dukkha. It's as simple as that. Nibbana goes beyond existence. Within existence, dukkha is. And if we accept that, we don't have to suffer from it. And this is the most important aspect of understanding dukkha. That it is, but we don't have to suffer from it. And once that has happened in our lives, then, of course, we are able to go ahead and have a lot of sukha on the spiritual path. That dukkha exists physically is a well-known fact. Even the Buddha had physical dukkha. And he said that the untrained, unenlightened disciple has two darts, two arrows that pierce him, whereas the enlightened disciple has only one. The one dart or arrow that pierces one is the body. Bodily pain is a given. But the unenlightened, untrained disciple reacts with the mind. So then, when the body hurts, the mind hurts with it. The body hurting is something that even the enlightened one cannot stop. But the mind hurting, that we can stop. So when we experience dukkha, and it is not necessarily physical dukkha, although that's part of it too, this body is so fragile and so prone to decay, disease, and death that there's always something wrong with it, whether it is old age or whether it's just a cold or whether it's a backache or whether it's a toothache, there's always something wrong with it, and we have to constantly look after it. But the mind does not have to go along with that. We also have to accept in the realm of dukkha that this body will never give satisfaction. Now, people who are older find that quite easy to accept. It's for the young ones where it's difficult. The Buddha called that the intoxication with youth. And Bernard Shaw said, youth is wasted on the young. This body needs constant care and attention because it's always falling apart. Once we see that as part of this whole dukkha existence, we may get an inkling that it might be much better not to reappear in such a body. Once we get that idea, samvega arises, urgency, the urgency to practice. This body has to have food, put in, digest, go out. And again, put it in, digest, and come out. A constant process of in and out. It has to be constantly cared for with being cleaned, with having rest, with cutting this off, cutting something else off, with taking medicine for something. There's a constant array and bother about the body. It is hardly possible to say that this body gives pleasure. When one is very young, this is difficult to see because the body is still very strong and doesn't have too many aches and pains. So it is more difficult to accept the fact that it would be much better without one. But if you can imagine for just 1 minute that you were sitting here in meditation without a body, wouldn't it be much nicer, much easier? Maybe that can give a good idea on how unfortunate it is to have such a body. However, the Buddha said, this is the best realm, the human one, to gain enlightenment, because we have plenty of dukkha, particularly with this body. But it doesn't come to the point of having no sukha at all. We do have sukha, pleasure. So there is a balance which makes it possible for us to practice. In the lower realms, lower than human, the dukkha is so great that practice is almost impossible. In the realms above us, the sukha is so much greater that the urgency to practice disappears. There are always devas present who are practicing, but they are a minority. But then, of course, with humans it's the same. We're also a minority. Anyway, with this body giving us this constant poke that something should be done, we then need to find out that it's actually the reaction in the mind which brings about the dukkha. And again, I'm going to refer to the unpleasant feelings that we get when sitting. If we have no reaction to them, no dukkha. It's only the reaction to the unpleasant feeling which brings the dukkha. So this is a very important practice point, which can be done right here and now. We don't have to dream of dukkha in the future, or that we ever get rid of it, or something like that. We have it with us right now. We get unpleasant feelings in the sitting position after some time, and it's only painful if we want it otherwise. If we accept it as it is, just as an unpleasant feeling, there is no suffering at all. And this is what the Buddha talked about when he said that we have two darts that poke us. The enlightened one only has the body to worry about. That dukkha stands at the apex of the transcendental depend arising is clear, because it also stands at the apex of the Buddha's explanation of his enlightenment. The very first thing he said was that there is the noble truth of dukkha. And because this is stressed, often it is misunderstood to say that the Buddha's teaching is pessimistic, or that it stresses only those aspects in us which are suffering and pain and unhappiness. But it's just the opposite. His teaching shows us what there is that is unsatisfactory and how to overcome it. He said, there's only one thing I teach, and that's suffering. It's often thought that the Buddha teaches a doctrine where suffering is going to go away because one has meditated long enough, or something like that, or suffering is going to go away because one sees everything differently. It's not that at all. Suffering isn't going to go away. The one who suffers is going to go away. And that is the way of the dependent arising, the transcendental dependent arising. The Buddha also said, there is the deed but no doer. There is suffering but no sufferer. There is the path, but no one to enter. There is Nibbana, but no one to attain it. Now again, it doesn't mean that we can't attain it, but it means that if I want Nibbana, it's out of reach. It may be sounding like one of those Zen paradoxes, but it will become quite clear as we go along. At the apex of the whole of this dependent arising stands the fact of dukkha, the fact of the unsatisfactoriness of existence. And all of us are experiencing it. We are experiencing the fact that we are not totally satisfied. We're experiencing the fact that there have been things in our lives which we would rather not have had happen. There have been things in our life which we would want, and they didn't come about. And they are coming, they're happening now. So when we have dukkha now, the best way to look at it is with gratitude that it is happening again to teach us that important lesson. It is useless to want it to go away. It's impermanent, it will go away anyway. But if we don't learn the lesson that it's trying to teach us, it will come back in exactly the same manner. If we learn this particular lesson, it will come back in a different way. Until we see it for what it is, universal existence, nothing else. None of us have a monopoly on it. None of us are picked out to have particular dukkha. It just is. The acceptance of it just is the first step towards realizing this path. Dukkha is. And there are people who live very pleasant lives, and can still realize it. There are people who live very unpleasant lives and don't realize it at all. They're blaming circumstances. They're blaming the government. In some cases, they're blaming the atom bomb. In some cases, they're blaming the economy. All sorts of ideas what people have, what they can blame. Yet, they can see in their life that it is something that they need to learn from. We have that opportunity every day. There's hardly a human being that wouldn't have some dukkha every day. And not necessarily physical. And that, to use that, to see the connection between the first and second noble truth, makes it so much easier to realize the practice path. The connection is the wanting, the either wanting to have or to wanting to get rid of. That's the connection. And in everything that we experience as unpleasantness, that is the underlying cause. And once we can find the cause, what it is that makes us either want this or not want that, we can also learn to drop it. And learning to drop it will then give us so much more ease, so much more energy, which is set free for the practice of this path. Because while we're still using our energy, our mental energy, to want certain things and not want others, we are not quite free enough to use it to practice with great determination. I once gave a meditation course for a bunch of youngsters, teenagers, on my nun's island, and I wanted them to have the personal experience of what it meant to get rid of dukkha. So I asked them to do an experiment to find out in themselves whether there was anything that was making them feel dissatisfied, unhappy, anything at all. And then for just one moment, drop that wish of either having or not having and see whether dukkha disappeared. And the next day I asked them whether they had done the experiment. And one said, yes, she had done it. I don't know about the others, only that one said she had done it. And I said, well, what did you do? She said, well, since she'd been on the island, all the time she had been coveting this little bell and cushion and tassel. And she'd been thinking about how to make one like that and where she could get one like that and how she could maybe find out where it is possible to purchase it. And she realized that with thinking like that, after I told about dukkha, she realized that this was making her very unhappy and very agitated. And so she just forgot about this little tassel and cushion and bell, and she felt very happy. So I could maybe recommend the same kind of experiment to you. It's not going to turn into this, I know. This was in Sri Lanka, where things are a little harder to come by. Our material needs are well taken care of in the West. But look inside as an experiment and see what it is that gives you dissatisfaction, that you're not satisfied with. What is it that has any kind of hold on you that gives a little bit of anxiety, a little bit of worry? Is it the future? What is it? And then, just for a moment, drop the whole thing. Just let it go. And feel the relief. And then after having done it for one moment, maybe you can do it for many moments. It is a worthwhile experiment, especially if you can find something inside of you that has been recurring, something that is a recurring dukkha agitator. It was useful for these teenagers to experiment like that, because the words are concepts. It's the experience that counts. We always compare this with the taste of the mango. If one tries to tell somebody what a mango tastes like, all you can say is, it tastes very nice, it's very sweet, it's delicious, it's very juicy, it's very soft. But does he know what a mango tastes like? He has to bite into it, and then he knows. It's not a peach, it's not an apricot, it's a mango, it's different. And the same with all of this. It's all taught by the Buddha for the only reason to experience it ourselves. But his guidelines are the important aspect that we have then, when we use the guidelines, we have the understood experience. We have the experience within and we know what it is. And that's why his words are of such importance to us, but only when we use them. Knowing them is one aspect. Remembering them is the second. And then actually working with them to experience it ourselves. Those are the three steps that make wisdom arise. I think that's enough about dukkha this morning.